This is the Education Gadfly Show.
It was a part of our Friendly Days festival that I helped to organize. Oh. We were trying to make Michigan a friendlier campus.
Did it work?
No.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who's been missing for weeks straight from Zuccotti Park, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey.
I think I saw pictures of you on the internet today of, you know, getting tear gassed and pushed out of Zuccotti Park. You were wearing those flip-flops and shorts you always do.
I like to hang with people who know how to dress for comfort.
Yes, exactly. So, do you have any sympathy for the Occupy Wall Street crowd?
Nah, not really.
No? None? Zero?
Pretty much zero.
If you were 20 years old, would you be there with them?
No.
Why not? It doesn't look like fun. It doesn't...
That looks like fun. I mean, I think being able to commandeer a public park, urinate in public, chant, be obnoxious, annoy people, not have to pursue
work. This sounds like it would have been right
sounds
up your alley.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
I mean, that was always your thing. You were always a troublemaker.
I wasn't really. No.
Oh, come on. You go out at night and you get into fistfights and stuff.
But I want to try to make a social cause out of the fact that I wanted to amuse myself.
Right.
I mean, that's what bothers me about this, the smug arrogance of this. Mm-hmm. If they now what's, you know, I would be much more sympathetic if these guys were saying, you know what, instead of saying we want somebody else to pay off our student loans, which is what got us in this mess in the first place, if they were saying we think you old people ought to be taking 60 cents on the dollar for Social Security and dialing back your Medicare benefits,
right,
then I would have a lot of sympathy.
Yeah.
Instead, they just want more of the free stuff for themselves too.
Right.
I'm not sympathetic.
I gotcha. But, you know, those rich people, they're going to pay the bill. They're not paying their fair share, Rick.
Apparently.
Yeah. I just can't get myself excited about hating the super rich, you know? And I'm not sure why. I mean, I understand. I mean, look, the Gilded Age stuff, we studied this in history. I understand the idea that this concentration of wealth.
I mean, I
got
to say, I despise, I despise the Kardashians and the Hiltons and a whole bunch of these. But I also got to say, the top 5, 10% of earners pay more than 50% of all income taxes collected by the federal government.
Yeah.
Bottom half of earners pay nothing in federal income tax.
But they all pay on other things.
They pay Medicare and Social Security, but these are programs where you get all your money back in theory.
Right.
And today's retirees get more than their money back. So these people, their only contribution to the federal government is to participate in a Ponzi scheme in which they expect to benefit. I got no sympathy for them.
Whew. Rick Hess speaking on behalf of the 1%. I love it.
I do what I can, baby.
Somebody's got to do it. And who else but the American Enterprise Institute, huh?
I like to come at people out of left field.
The 1%'s organ in Washington, D.C. I like it. All right. Hey, lots to talk about. Can't just talk about social commentary, Daniela. We got some education things to talk about. It's Let's Talk About Cool Things Mike Has Written week.
All right. Ooh, that's a good week.
Yeah, you like that? Yeah. No, that's not entirely true. But we have some good stuff to talk about, some controversies out there. Let's get started, Daniela. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Excellent. Thanks, guys. Question number one. This week, Fordham is releasing two more papers in our virtual school series, one looking at the role of teachers in the digital learning future, and another at the ideal funding structure for virtual education. What do the papers tell us, Mike?
First of all, Daniela, it's not virtual schools. We know from the pollsters that's out. People don't like that. People don't want to have their kid go to a virtual school.
What do they want?
Digital learning. That polls well.
Ready to give up on Ed.
Get with the picture, buddy. Now Rick was the first one in our series on digital learning, talking about quality control. Now we have Brian Hassel and Emily Hassel on teachers.
They're heavy hitters.
Heavy hitters. And Paul Hill on funding.
He's a heavy
Boom.
Hitter.
Big. And big they're shots. very nice papers. Look, the Hassels make their cases, they have in some other places, but with some new wrinkles on how to expand the reach of high quality teachers using technology. They admit that, look, yes, some teachers are going to lose their jobs because of digital learning. Teachers who aren't very good, we're going to need fewer teachers, conceivably, but we might need more of different roles. So if you're able to then the reach of the high-performing teachers via technology, you still might need some different kinds of people, like aides, lower-level people, to monitor computer rooms and things like that. Paul Hill makes the case that basically our funding system is horrible for digital learning. There's no efficient way of getting the money to these programs, except if you're talking about virtual charter schools. They're the one workaround that really seems to be effective because you can get a lump sum payment to these schools for full-time online learning, and there's a lot of flexibility. He wants weighted student funding for everybody. That means redoing our education system writ large. He also likes the idea of giving parents some discretion over public dollars through some kind of debit card that you could use for some supplemental online learning materials. Does that sound about about right, Rick?
Sounds good to me, man.
Yeah. So is there any chance, we've been talking about wasted student funding for what feels like forever now, and there's been zero movement on it anywhere that I can tell. Is there any hope for that? Why are
actually
we...
that's a good thing, because it's exactly like teacher evaluation. If they'd actually done weighted student funding and people had baked this in, turns out the weighted student funding is a horrible way to unbundle the way you spend dollars and facilitate different kinds of provision.
Why is that?
What do you mean, why is that?
Why?
Because weighted student funding presumes that the dollars are following the kid to a school.
It doesn't have to. You could do weighted student funding and then make it be able to break it up.
But that's not the way it's been talked about for the past. Yeah, but it's not the way it's been talked about for the past decade.
Yeah.
So the problem is that if you write that, they would have written it ever more firmly in, because right, what you're doing is you're trying to unpack staffing formulas at schools,
right,
which aren't based at all on dollars following kids.
Right.
If you're going to have the dollars follow kids, you want to have them follow kid into virtual ed savings accounts or virtual credit cards. So it's good. It's good we didn't do this before.
Now we can do it the right way.
Yeah, we won't do it.
Look, but, thing, let's just stop this whole local funding of education thing, property tax. This is where I become a big lefty, man. Just do it all at the state level. Equalize it. Okay. Fairness, people. Yes. I'm with Jonathan Kozol on this one. Get rid of the, look, I mean, if we're going to do wasted student funding right, if we're going to fund digital learning right, you got to get rid of these disparities from district to district, right? Mm. So you just stop doing the whole local property taxes thing.
So you just, you know, so you just bought a new house this summer, Mike.
That's right.
And part, it's non-trivial part of the value of that house, of course, was the school district. And
Sure.
So so you're comfortable not only for you, but for everybody else who played by those rules, stripping $50,000 or $100,000 of, you know, purchase value out of your pocket.
Because you're assuming, what if we have to have some of our education dollars shipped to other parts of Maryland?
If you equalize, I mean, no. I mean, right, we just know this, right? If you equalize, especially if you equalize statewide, right, you wipe out effectively what it means to have these school systems. What you're going to do is you are going to elevate the homes of people who didn't purchase homes in good communities and schools, and you're going to depress the value of those and the others.
I'm for the greater good, Rick.
That's beautiful.
Topic number two.
Okay. Confiscation.
Yes.
It goes so easy.
Somewhat along those lines, in the aftermath of the Ohio referendum, reformers are rethinking the best way to fight teacher unions and adult interest groups. Should we be focusing energy on changing state law, on abolishing school boards with our union incest and politicking, campaigning for reform-minded school board members? What?
Yeah. So, Rick, I wrote a piece this week, basically said, look, you know, what we've been trying to do with the collective bargaining reform, even you could argue with mayoral control, with charter schooling, is we're trying to deal with the fact that in many places we have these union-dominated school boards. We have this asymmetry, particularly in urban areas, let's say, where you've got very powerful unions negotiating with very weak school boards, or school boards that have been captured by the unions. And so we're trying. So the collective bargaining thing was trying to rein that in. That didn't go over so well in Ohio. So the question now is, hey, should we just get off our butts and have reformers go in and take over the school boards? Or option number two, just get rid of the school boards entirely.
Well, so I mean, there's actually three things, right? So taking over school boards kind of suggests to me that you're going to, what, airlift in a whole bunch of people with rifles and they're going to do coup d'etats on school, right?
We're going to send in a bunch of Caprice Youngs and run them for election in school board races.
But that's different from taking over school.
That's what I mean. It's having reformers run in these elections.
Issuing a bunch of rifles to Caprices to go airlift in, I have problems with.
Yes, I would too.
Plus,
I think Caprice is tough. I mean,
she is tough. To identify strong candidates, fund them, and help them win office is actually what we usually call democracy. So I am, not only do I think there's no problem with that, I think that is entirely consistent with our tradition.
Isn't that we've been trying to take shortcuts from that?
Yes. Well, but it's also the case but here's where I think the collective bargaining interpretation is a little glib, that I think it gives way too much credit to superintendents. Mm-hmm. I think most superintendents, whether or not their local union affiliates are particularly engaged, or no matter the composition of their board, prefer not to try to take, prefer not to seek givebacks on benefits, on expenditure, on steps and lanes, because it's easier not to, because it's conflictual, because it causes headaches. So I think the notion that what we were trying to do was reset collective bargaining to fight unions is actually too generous to school leaders today and district leaders. I think we're trying to do it because we have a generation of educational leaders who are failing to fulfill the responsibilities of their job, even when they're able to do so.
Topic number three, Daniela.
Last week, Mike wrote a blog post on Flypaper entitled, "We Have a Parenting Problem, Not a Poverty Problem." That true?
Mike, what do you mean by that?
What I meant was that it's not the lack of money per se that is the problem when you look at low performance among disadvantaged kids. It's behaviors, right? It's that they're, first of all, that their parents, in most cases, are single parents, right? That we've, you know, most of these poor kids are being born to single parent families. We know that makes a lot of things a lot harder to do. A lot of the things that make for good parenting, say in the mold of sort of upper middle class families, in some cases it takes money or money helps. In a lot of cases it doesn't take money, but it takes time and attention and turning off the television and being there to encourage good practices, and that these things are a lot harder to do if you're trying to raise a child by yourself. And so it basically trying to make the case that, as Mitch Perlstein does in a new book and others, and as conservatives used to make all the time but have been silent on, that look, you know, if we're talking about solving our education problems, that the broader bolder people want to talk about government programs being the solution. Conservatives used to talk about, you know, trying to deal with the family breakdown and re-energizing marriage, particularly in these disadvantaged communities, as part of the solution. And then that's what the post is about, saying, mm-hmm. look, you know, we're only going to get so far if we continue to have this portion of society being born to single parents. And then, you know, for parents doing things that perhaps aren't the best parenting techniques.
Yeah, I mean, I think I buy most of that. I mean, I think that there's two things, right? One, that I think, poverty does matter in its own right, even aside from behaviors. But, impoverished family, being in poverty just makes it harder to give kids experiences, whether it's travel or summer camp or exposure or tutoring or any number of things. Mm-hmm. It's also the case that families in poverty, right, if you have a single parent and they don't read well or they're illiterate, it's a whole lot harder for them mm-hmm. than to do useful things like read to their kids, much less if they're illegal immigrants and they're not fluent in English language and all the mm-hmm. things that means. So I think that, you know, those are also real considerations. But yeah, I mean, I think your larger point is exactly right. We used to spend a lot of time talking about what are parents, what's their obligation. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with the achievement gap focus has been that we've put it all on educators. Mm-hmm. And we've said, well, you know, every parent loves their kid. And which may or may not be true, but I sure as hell don't think every parent's doing the right stuff by their kid, mm-hmm. and we've given them a pass.
And this is not to say that our schools are doing everything right, and if only parents were picking up their slack. I mean, we know that our schools could be doing dramatically better, given where the kids are coming from. But, you know, when people talk especially about closing the achievement gap, you know, like we're going to get to some point where we're going to take some kids over here coming from affluent, well-educated, two-parent families, getting all these things at home and just getting, you know, really strong early childhood experiences, and other kids coming from poverty and single parents and, you know, all the chaos and dysfunction, and we're going to say that we're surprised that those kids on average have different outcomes.
Well, more than one thing can be true at a time. Just like, you know, what we often say, look, it is true that teacher union contracts are a huge hindrance for smart district leadership. It is also true that those guys, even when they're free to act, aren't doing their bit. It is true that our schools are consistently letting down kids across this country, including very much in the urban core.
Mm-hmm.
But saying that doesn't make it any less true that parents have manifestly failed to do their piece, in huge swaths of the country. And it's not a question of one or the other. It is that schools have to be, you know, held responsible for doing a hell of a lot better. Mm-hmm. But we got to stop letting parents off the hook.
70% of African-American babies born in this country today out of wedlock mothers, 60% Latino parents, close to 40% of white parents. Right, we don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about it. All right, that is the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
It's nice to have the three of us here together. We haven't done this in a while.
It's been a while.
Nice and cozy.
I miss you guys like this. It is cozy.
Me too.
Yeah.
And Am's back from Shanghai.
Shanghai.
Yes, indeed.
Beijing.
You missed. We heard all about it.
A special edition last week that you missed.
I was totally tuned into it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I loved it. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. Especially where you
What talk, was one thing I said?
You talked about how, you know, it strikes you that we often talk about how there's 50 kids in a classroom in China. But what we rarely note is that those teachers teach only two classes a day and have lots of time for prep.
I believe I said that at your AEI event and not on the podcast that you supposedly listened to.
I assume you'd also said
that
on the podcast.
That was pretty good, I have to say.
Now, you were thinking you listened to it, weren't you?
Pretty impressed.
Right.
That man, Rick, has all those young staff members. They must have given him that.
They gave me a transcription of his awesome.
All right, Amber, what you got for us?
All right, we got the new Keeping Pace report. It was a little dry in research land, but anyway, a couple interesting stats. So this is
Keeping Pace
is the annual report on state of K-12 online learning. I was getting to that.
Issued by who?
Evergreen Education.
And who's Evergreen?
They're a consulting. Are we trying to get this done or not? They're a consulting firm that specializes in reporting on online education on an annual basis.
You know, there's also Everclear.
Yeah, there is, but it's Evergreen.
You sure it's not Everclear?
That's the alcohol that you probably consume on a regular basis. Anyway, onward I go.
Wow, could you sound like any less fun when you do that?
Big theme. Here we go. I'm just charging ahead. Single district programs are the fastest growing segment of online and blended learning, which is depressing. This is a district run program intended only for that district students. This includes full and part-time programs, credit recovery, summer school, AP courses, you name it. Most of these are blended, not fully online. A couple other little stats here. 40 states have state virtual schools. Course enrollments are up by 19% over last year. Online education is growing. We had about 200,000 students in 09-10, 250,000 in 10-11 across 30 states. So we're still seeing this inch up. Most states fund at a per student level between 6 and 7,000. Still, we know this already. Funding's really problematic. They have a section in there that this is just a mess because states use average daily attendance or enrollment on day one, which doesn't make sense in an online framework. Finally, last little factoid here. I guess there's just people upset. There's still disparities, you know, in what these kids look like. So poor kids are underrepresented nationally. 45% are free and reduced lunch. They make up 21% of online students. Similar with SPED. SPED are about 13% nationwide. They're about 6% online. ELLs are about 11% nationally, 2% online. So I don't think this is surprising, but some people are trying to make something of this. What does this mean that these kids are represented in smaller proportions in online settings? So there you have it.
Boom.
Boom. I think there's disparities in what kids look like. Yeah. Some kids are better looking. Some kids not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids are just painful to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we're not really allowed to talk about that.
No, we're not.
We're not, right. Just like parenting.
Yeah.
Just got to pretend they're all attractive.
They're all equal. So the single district.
The district.
All right,
man.
So this means that basically, you know, everybody's doing their own thing, creating their own virtual school, or contracting with various companies that are out there saying, hey, hire us and we'll help you build your own online learning or blended learning program.
Well, you know, the tricky thing is it would be hard to imagine using technology to serve kids in more than one district at a time.
Yeah, that'd be a real tough one. I mean, so this is clear. Look, this is our governance system at work.
This is terrible.
I mean, this is our funding system at work.
I think he says, like, strangling the baby in the crib. I mean, you know, this is supposed to be, I mean, already the inventiveness here is... Yep. Being squashed.
Yeah. But it's not surprising. This is the system we have. And people can't figure out how to get dollars to schools that aren't run by districts. Mm-hmm. How does the governance system work? I mean, this school districts are doing what they know how to do, which is, okay, we should do online learning. Let's do it ourselves or get somebody to help us. You know, some of these companies are okay. They come in and say, look, we'll help you set this up. And then you'll get access through us to a variety of online courses and offerings. But surely it is not the whole universe of online courses. And there's all kinds of... You know, you could call it innovation or questions about, you know, how the pricing works and what do you get access to, what don't you, what's free, what's been developed. This is not the best way to go.
And then you have certain states mandating that kids have to take two courses online, you know, which is kind of crazy. So
what's this? 40 states have
statewide virtual schools?
Like Florida virtual school stuff?
Well, I don't know if they're, you know, that big. I mean, Florida virtual school is pretty big, but yeah, they have 40.
Florida virtual's got like a 250,000 kids.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah. A lot of kids.
That's interesting. All right.
Keeps growing.
Well, look, this is a promising idea, but I think what we're seeing, it's all about the governance. I mean, hey, as long as we keep sending money through school districts and we're going to keep this geographical focus, it's crazy. We got to unleash it, baby. Unleash it. And I think the virtual charter schools seem to be the most promising way to do that.
All about the governance, huh?
Yeah.
So do you have a nickname for this, like a reform realism? What's your governance moniker?
You know, we have not come up with something really good yet on governance.
We've got till December 1st
Yeah, our big conference on governance. I think that's really why the governance conversation hasn't gone off the ground yet, is we don't have a cute name for it.
In my PiNet thing, I had you pushing Gucci governance.
Yes.
Gucci governance.
Oh, like, what does that mean?
High quality governance at Gucci.
Oh, high quality.
Yeah, it has alliteration, so I'm in favor of it.
Pretty much what Mike does is alliterate things.
Yeah, That's
what I do.
It's
a talent.
Yeah.
Joe's given us this little signal that means wrap it up, people.
Okay. Okay. So what's the song that goes along with this?
So we have, I don't know the song. Maybe you guys do. Somebody found it for me. Somebody, meaning Joe. It's called Run Around by Blues Traveler. Since the name of the report is Keeping Pace. Get it? Huh?
Oh, once upon a midnight, dear, you woke with something in my head. I couldn't escape the memory of a phone call and of what you said. Like a game show contestant with a parting gift, I cannot believe my eyes. When I saw through the thoughts of a trusted friend, who needs to humor me and tell me lies. Yeah, humor me and tell me lies.
Song. You know, I remember Blues Traveler coming to my college, University of Michigan. It was a part of our Friendly Days festival that I helped to organize.
Oh.
We were trying to make Michigan a friendlier campus.
Did it work?
No, but we had a lot of fun.
I like Blues Traveler. John Popper was, I guess he is. Is he still? I mean,
I don't know. Was he the fat guy? Years.
He was the fat guy.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
He's thinner.
He's thinner now? Oh, he's thinner now. Yeah.
I thought Joe was like, squeeze it along.
That's what I thought.
He's like, Popper ain't so fat no more. But no, they just, I dig their stuff.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, hey, it's now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, I.
Chris, Rick, and I have been bantering too much, so we got to speed it along here. What's up this week?
Doing more with less. Stretching the school dollar. That's exactly what one innovative thinker has done at Jefferson County Public Schools in Colorado. By placing an unobtrusive 2-inch ad for College Savings Fund on the report cards of students in its 91 elementary schools, the district was able to raise $90,000. Ingenious! Take what otherwise would have been blank space on a paper and sell it for almost six figures of profit. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the $70 million in budget cuts the district faces over the next 2 years, but hey, every $90,000 counts. To no surprise, Valerie Strauss took the time to call for the demise of, quote, the bombardment of corporate advertisement in schools, on her Washington Post blog. Jay Green was quite blunt in dubbing Strauss the high priestess in the Diane Ravitch cult, and it seems this post does nothing but confirm that. These districts, desperately strapped for cash, are devising creative methods to generate extra revenue, yet people like Strauss condemn them on the basis of slippery slope. If it were my school, I'd be selling advertisements left and right. Naming rights to the auditorium, gymnasium, and football fields would be at the top of the list. Move the logos aside and replace the front of school-provided sporting uniforms with the names of sponsors. It works quite well for the hundreds of European soccer teams that do it. Our current times call for innovative new solutions. Nobody benefits from the public voices doing nothing but shooting down ideas. But what should we expect besides more of the same from that camp? What's up with that?
Whew, taking money out of the mouths of babes they are. What do you think on this, Rick?
I'm with Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure about necessarily the total commercialization, but...
Yeah, yeah. See,
but certainly the 2 inches in the newsletter, yeah. I got... Really? So Valerie Strauss would rather see Jeffco fire a teacher than sell 2 inches of space to an advertiser?
Yeah, that's going to parents, right?
Right.
I mean, report cards are going to parents.
Students aren't seeing this. This is an advertisement to parents.
Look, this is like the school bus thing.
Savings account also seems to me like somebody who's actually thinking about
it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is worthwhile. This is a good positive. Look, like school buses, I say advertisements on the outside of the buses, I'm fine with. Okay. Advertisements on the inside of the buses, I would have a problem with.
What if it's like a Crest toothpaste advertisement
on the inside of the bus?
Yeah.
That creates a moral dilemma for me. I'll have to think about that one. Anyway, I don't have time to figure it out this week because we're out of time, folks. So until next time,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.